program are those of the host and the participants.
All right, greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus here on WILL AM 580. We have another show today to deal with the state of the economy and how the media covers it and what's going on in the world of the economy, both in the United States, internationally, and what's going on, has gone on in recent years. We are very fortunate today to have as our guest Robert Poland, an economist from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And Bob Poland has written several books, one of them, The Living Wage with Stephanie Luce, an edited volume, Transforming the U.S. Financial System, and his newest book, which we'll be talking about today, Contours of Dissent, a highly acclaimed book just published by Verso. It is my pleasure to welcome to Media Matters Bob Poland. Bob, you there?
I'm here.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I know you're on your vacation, is that right? Or you're
No. I'm just kind of moving around.
Okay, moving around. Okay, well, we tracked you down.
Thanks. So I'm very happy to be on the show, Bob.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners, if you could, the title of your new book is Contours of Dissent, U.S. Economic Fractures in the Landscape of Global Austerity. In a nutshell, what does the title refer to, Contours of Dissent?
Well, descent, going down.
Yeah.
And, the basic thrust of what's happened over the last generation in terms of the global economy and the U.S. economy has been, well, as my subtitle says, a fracture. The distribution of income has gotten more and more skewed. The old cliche, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. That's actually happening both in the U.S. and globally. So that's the nature of the descent. Moreover, the just basic things like the growth of U.S. economy and globally in the third world, the growth of the economy has slowed significantly. So you have a situation where the pie is growing more slowly, and then the slices of the more slowly growing pie are getting more and more unequal. That is being experienced most severely in the developing world, where, of course, the standard of living is, in any case, lower. So you have really increasing severe poverty, far less opportunities for a decent life. And in the U.S., we really have a fundamental problem of what are going to be the jobs that are going to be decent jobs for people living and working in this country. So those are the things that I was trying to refer to with the descent. I would also say, though, that the last chapter of my book is called Another Path is Possible, and I do try to lay out some positive alternatives for turning around the contours of dissent.
Well, in the book, you talk about the new economy of Bill Clinton, and the 1990s have been held up as a sort of an outstanding example of really a boom economy, a new post-industrial economy in the United States with extraordinary growth and low inflation and high-income jobs. And in recent years, with the new recession and the change in administration, many, especially Democrats, have pointed to the Clinton years nostalgically. Your book is not especially generous to Clinton in this regard. Could you tell us what you write about the Clinton administration and their economic policies and how they compare to the Bush administration?
Yeah. Well, I think this is a very important point for people on the left, or even moderate left to real left, to understand that the Clinton policies, and in particular the economy under Clinton, was by no means this unbridled success story that a lot of people have held it up to be. There are some things that create that impression. One of them is the fact that you did have low unemployment and low inflation, which all economics textbooks say it could never happen. It did happen, but the reason it happened, the most important reason it happened, is, as Alan Greenspan himself said, when asked under congressional testimony, why do we have low unemployment and low inflation? And Greenspan said, well, it's because workers in the U.S. are traumatized. This is Alan Greenspan talking. Now, what that meant was that you normally, when you have low unemployment, workers feel emboldened to bargain for higher wages. And when you get those higher wages, businesses then try to pass on the higher wages by raising their prices. Well, we didn't have the inflation, and the main reason is that workers did not feel emboldened. Workers feel threatened by globalization and by the lack of institutional support to protect them against international competition and to protect them against capitalists forcing them, threatening them with leaving and so forth. So that's the basis. That is the main reason why we were able to experience low unemployment and low inflation. So I don't really consider that a success story. The second one was the stock market boom. And we all know now that the stock market boom was an absurd bubble brought on in part by highly creative accounting practices, but more fundamentally that people just wanted to believe that the stock market was going to go up forever. This has happened many, many times throughout history. In fact, it almost happens on a regular basis, and the only thing that stops it is regulating this insanity. And when the Clinton administration decided to stop regulating it, then that's why we got a stock market bubble. So those are the things that created the impression. And the third thing was the transition from government deficits to government surpluses. And the main reason that happened is that they simply froze spending on government programs. So that, you know, okay, we ran a surplus, but we also cut back dramatically on spending on education, on environmental protection relative to the size of the economy. So I don't really consider those great success stories. I mean, and then by basic indicators, the average wage at the end of the Clinton administration was still about 10% below what it was under Nixon in 1973. The poverty rate was only slightly better than it was under Reagan. And after all the justified attacks on Reaganomics for what it did to the poor, we got essentially no benefit, no improvement under Clinton. So add all those things together, it was really not a success story.
We're talking to Robert Pollin today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Robert Pollin is the author of the new and highly acclaimed book, Contours of Descent, D-E-S-C-E-N-T, a la Darwin. If you'd like to call in and have a question for Robert Pollin today on Media Matters, our telephone number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Going on now to the George W. Bush administration, have there been any substantial changes in policies in Washington that are notable regarding the economy?
Oh, absolutely. And I certainly don't want to suggest that there are no matter how bad Clinton was, I don't want to suggest that there's no difference between Clinton and Bush. What Bush did was say, well, yes, his initial idea was to say, well, we do have a surplus. I mean, in the 2000 election, the key economic issue was what to do with the surplus. And it was the Democrats, it was Gore that was saying, well, we're going to keep running surpluses every year until we eliminate government debt altogether. The government should be debt-free. That was an almost totally incoherent idea. It had no appeal politically. There was absolutely no reason why he should do that. But anyway, that was it. Bush, on the other hand, said, well, let's give the money back to the people. We're running a surplus. Okay, so let's cut taxes. And that was the insertion point for these tax cuts for the rich, which has been the fundamental theme of his administration throughout. And those have been disastrous. They've been disastrous in that they have redistributed income to the rich, which already was going on dramatically under Clinton, even more so now under Bush. And then secondly, it has created this situation which the Republicans really want, which is to say we are heading towards a budgetary crisis, and what do we do about it? Well, we can't raise taxes because big government is bad. So what we have to do is start cutting back more in programs. Now, we're not going to cut back in the military because, of course, we're being threatened by terrorists. So we have to cut back social spending, which is what the Republicans have wanted all along. And so they're recreating a Reagan-like economy where you're cutting taxes on the rich and you're building up the military and you're running a huge deficit, creating the opportunity or creating the argument in behalf of more cuts in social spending. The outcome has been, for example, the state and local fiscal crises, which have been so devastating, including my own university and probably your university, but throughout the country, where we've faced severe cuts in these fundamental social programs like public education.
We're talking to Bob Poland today, the author of the new book, Contours of Dissent, the economist from the University of Massachusetts. If you'd like to call in, our number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Urbana, you're on the air with Robert Poland.
Hello. I have, I guess it's a basic economics 101 question related to politics and how the media covers it. The trade deficit, for a long time, I don't know how long it's been, has, I mean, there, we have had a very large trade deficit, and it seems that we're, you know, spending, that as a whole, we're, more money is going out of the country than going in, and the media, I'd sort of like to try to understand it in terms of the average person, maybe the, you know, a typical middle-class person, what effect, long-term effect would it have on a middle-class person's life, economic life? And the media, the mass media doesn't seem to ever be able to translate these macro, that this macroeconomic condition into sort of a microeconomic condition. That's just my question is, is the media remiss in this, or is it just too difficult to understand?
You know, if I can interject, Bob, why don't you start with this whole question of balance of trade or payment deficit, because that seems to be such a huge issue in the world economy. And then after you've sort of addressed that, maybe talk a little bit about how the news media tends to cover economic issues like that.
Sure. Well, I mean, it is a fundamental problem. There's really almost no effort to do anything about it.
And could you explain what the problem is?
Yeah,
because I think a lot of our listeners hear about it, but they really are pretty clueless.
Yeah, okay. So here's the issue. The issue is this, that, I mean, we're looking, if we look over a long trajectory, a lot of manufacturing jobs in the United States are going to move overseas for the simple reason that we know that the wages are lower and that, in particular, now with improvements in communication technology and transportation technology, it's not that hard to produce manufactured goods in, say, Mexico, Central America, China, and then bring them to the United States and have them be produced more cheaply than they were in the U.S. So that's the fundamental problem, and that's a basic factor driving our trade deficit. Our trade deficit means that we import more things than we export. Now, that then creates another problem, which is if you keep importing more things than you export, that you're spending dollars, like let's say we're buying things from China and we're paying for them in dollars, and we're not balancing that with things that they're buying from us. So they're carrying more and more dollars. And what do they do with the dollars? Well, then they buy assets in the United States, or they put their money in banks in the United States, but then they increasingly have some decision-making over our economy because they can decide that they don't want dollars anymore. Now, a lot of economists, including progressive economists, say that that is the real crisis coming up, is that China and other countries are holding so many dollars, more than they want, that they're going to start to say, we don't want all these dollars, we're going to start dumping them and hold other things.
What's the problem with that, Bob?
Well, the problem with that is if they decide that, then that could mean that the value of the U.S. dollar could fall precipitously. Now, the real problem, and here's what I want to get to the crux of this, if we play out that scenario, what I really think would happen is this, that if holders of dollars all over the world decide, well, we just can't keep holding dollars, it's not going to mean like a total financial collapse. The most likely scenario is that the U.S. Federal Reserve would raise interest rates in the United States. And the reason they would do that would be to keep making the dollar attractive to foreigners that are holding the dollars, and that they could earn more money off of holding dollars. So they would raise interest rates in the United States to keep attracting foreign dollar holders, and that would then mean that it would be more expensive for workers to borrow money to buy a car or buy a home or send their children to college. And that would mean a further redistribution of income from working people to the rich. I think that's the likely scenario. And so all of this comes back to this problem of this trade deficit, of the fact that we are buying a lot more than we are selling abroad. And what I think, you know, the real issue for politics, for U.S. politics, is to figure out how to create decent jobs for workers in this country. That's the real issue, because then through that, you ameliorate the problem of the trade deficit. You then also reduce this crisis, the potential crisis of a dollar crash, and you then all in turn weaken the likelihood of this rise in interest rates, shutting off workers from the things they need to borrow by the rise in the interest rate wouldn't be as severe. So it all kinds of fits together. And until we address this, I mean, the whole thing about NAFTA, the debate about NAFTA and things like that are so empty because we don't really address the real issue, which is where are the jobs going to be for workers in this country? I mean, why can't our political process focus on that? I mean, that's ultimately the source of well-being for almost all people is their job.
You know, Bob, if I can interrupt, as I recall, the Clinton administration argued that, you know, it probably wasn't going to be realistic to think we're going to keep the big-paying manufacturing jobs because of lower wage competition around the world, but that good jobs would come through a highly educated workforce that would be getting these high-tech, white-collar jobs. Do you think that is a plausible solution to the problem?
Well, it's certainly, I mean, I think that the answer is that, you know, continued expansion of service sector, continued expansion of the types of jobs that are not likely to move, expansion of the public sector, you know, the types of services people want, education, health. But it's not what the Clinton administration's mistake was. Well, rhetorically, they said, well, therefore, we want to spend more on education. They didn't spend more on education, so they weren't even living up to their rhetoric. But just creating more educated people is not going to create more jobs. We already know that. People are way more educated than they were 25 years ago, but the job prospects are weaker than they were 25 years ago. So it's not a question of education, though education is a great thing, and I've been a teacher for, you know, a quarter of a century. So I believe in it, but that's not what's going to. We need to have actual policies focused on directly on creating jobs. On, for example, creating jobs in environmental new environmental infrastructures that are creating environmentally clean technologies and creating jobs at the same time. This would be a wonderful massive project for job creation and environmentalism, but it's not even on the radar screen.
And those sort of jobs, to follow up on this, because this is a very interesting idea, would come, I assume, from serious public sector initiative. I mean, if we just wait for private sector interests to take this up on their own, there's no evidence they will do so. Will
That's they? Right. There's no evidence. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that they won't do so. And this is the whole problem with letting the financial markets decide where money goes in this country. They are, number one, they are highly speculative. They run on wild rumors, on short-term thinking, but they are driving the decision-making as to where money goes in this economy. And that was the one insight from the New Deal. There are a few insights from the New Deal, but the one insight is if you're going to have anything looking like a capitalist economy, you can't let Wall Street run the show. You just can't. But that's where we are now, and that's where we were under Clinton. I mean, that was very clear right after Clinton got elected in 1992, on an agenda not that different than what I'm sketching out. It was called Putting People First. It was about jobs. It was about education. It was about infrastructure investments. But even before he took office, Robert Rubin of Goldman Sachs, who became his leading economic advisor, and Alan Greenspan, who was also his top advisor, they said, you know, Wall Street is going to set the agenda, and they did. And Clinton caved in on day one, before he even took office, and that was the problem under Clinton.
We've got a couple of callers waiting patiently to talk with Robert Polin, our guest today in Media Matters. Robert Polin is the author of Contours of Dissent, the highly acclaimed new book on the economic situation in the United States and world today. If you'd like to call in and speak with Bob Polin, the number is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to our very patient caller. San Diego, you're on the air with Robert Polin.
Thanks for taking my call. I've got a couple of questions, but if there's not enough time, cut me off after the first one. My first question is on universal health care. Since most countries that we compete with have socialized medicine or Medicare, if we were to move that off of the corporate books and onto a universal health care program, wouldn't that make the cost of our goods more competitive? You know, making that a reason for actually, you know, promoting universal health care.
Do you want to, why don't you give both your questions, caller, then we'll let hang up and open up the toll-free line.
Okay, my second question is on privatizing Social Security. Would the using, you know, maybe like index funds and vehicles like that, where we're actually investing in the stock market as a whole. I know that liberals don't usually like to hear, you know, privatizing of Social Security, but a portion of our Social Security dollars could be invested in our economy through an index mechanism or some type of investment vehicle like that. It really is a positive and progressive idea, I think. And I consider myself a liberal, so I'm not, you know, just pro-business or anything, but I think we do have to believe that our economy in the long term, not just short term, I'm not just talking about a two-year bubble, but if we look over long term, which is what our investment philosophy should be, that investing part of our money in the stock market isn't a bad idea. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. And, Bob, before you answer the questions concerning health care and Social Security, they really lead into the question we didn't get a chance to get to before, which was media coverage of economic issues, and health care and Social Security are probably two of the economic questions or economic-related questions that get the most attention in the news media. Yeah. From your experience, how would you characterize the press coverage, news media coverage of economic issues in general?
It's very schizophrenic, Bob, because I get called fairly often by reporters from big papers and small papers and, you know, all over. They when I do, they seem very intelligent. They ask good questions. They often write good stories. At the same time, most of the images that come out, the pictures that come out that seem dominant are they are unclear. I guess what reporters, you know, mainstream reporters in particular, feel like, you know, they have to always, they do what they call a balanced story, and a balanced story is they take this rabid right-wing position, and they'll take that as a serious view, and then they may squeak in, a little bit of an alternative. So that as the reader or the viewer or listener hears it, everything comes out as a total mess. There is some sense in which some of these issues are just difficult. And maybe it would be more honest for some reporters sometime to say, you know, I can't explain this in 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. The issues around the deficit, for example. There isn't a 30-second answer on the deficit. There may be a 5-minute answer. But, you know, maybe if the reporters were willing to say, you know, there are some difficult things, we can work through them in 5 minutes rather than 30 seconds. that would make it that would at least open things up.
Mm-hmm.
But the basic issue, and this is the one that I think that the press, the mainstream press, has just totally failed on. And it's not because the people are bad. It's maybe because it's the newspapers and the media are bad, as you and others like you have done a wonderful job showing, is the issue of jobs in this country. I mean, that this, why this is not the number one domestic economic issue. Where are the decent jobs? Why is it that, you know, wages are on average are 10 or 15% below where they were a generation ago, even though productivity is about 80% above what it was a generation ago? That seems to me, it has to be the number one U.S. economic issue, because that's the one that concerns everybody. And I think the mainstream media has failed on that. Not all the time. They do run stories some of the time, you know, but it, you know, it's in a mix with all this other stuff. And I think that, the owners of the media don't want that story to be front and center.
Well, Robert, let's take those two questions
quickly,
if we could, that the caller had first about single-payer health insurance. Wouldn't that be good for business?
Absolutely. Well, it certainly it'll
so
be
So isn't
good
that
for-
ironic, because that's presented as socialism, yet this would help our business because they could take the cost of health care off their books.
Right. Well, it wouldn't be good for some businesses. It wouldn't be good for insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, why can't the media say this clearly? I think some of the time they do. I don't. You know more. You monitor the media more carefully than I do. It absolutely would be good for U.S. Competitive businesses, manufacturing businesses. This thing with manufacturing is going abroad. The issue for the well-being of U.S. workers, though, is the pace, and we could slow down the pace, and we could have it so that people's jobs don't get wiped out so quickly, and communities aren't getting destroyed. And the way to do that is the U.S. Health insurance would certainly be a fundamental factor here to lower the cost of health insurance. And they don't do it because, you know, it would help out a lot of businesses somewhat, but the businesses that would just be totally wiped out massively by single payer are, of course, the health insurance companies. And they will fight tooth and nail, and they'll buy every politician they can, and have succeeded. And so that's what's blocking that.
How about Social Security, the idea of taking those funds and using them for private investment?
Well, Social Security has basically been a major success story in this country. The administrative costs are negligible. The main lobbying for privatizing Social Security is, of course, Wall Street. And they want it because, I mean, you're talking about, you know, billions of dollars in fees that they could get if they could get even a piece of the Social Security investment funds to privatize. In principle, I agree with your caller. I mean, in principle, if we said, well, look, over the long term, the stock market is going to yield somewhere between, you know, 5% and 7% over the long term, whereas the Social Security is, you know, 2% to 3%. So why can't we put some of it in the stock market?
Or in principle, just be take society should take its savings and put it the savings as most productive uses.
Yes. The problem, of course, is what happens in that transition. And what happens in that transition is absolutely, you know, frightening, that Wall Street would get their hands on this. They want it for obvious reasons, because they want the fees. They want to be handling that money. They want to direct it. And their track record is pretty bad, especially now. And I'm not ready to relinquish, you know, one penny to them, even though I agree with your caller that there, you know, as a matter of principle, there's no reason why, if it could be done safely, why the Social Security funds might not be put in some kind of safe fund that would yield slightly more than what's being yielded now.
We're talking to Robert Polin today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Robert Polin is the author of the new and highly acclaimed book, Contours of Dissent, U.S. Economic Fractures and the Landscape of Global Austerity. If you'd like to ask a question to Professor Polin, the number here, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to our very patient callers. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Bob Pollan.
Yeah, Dr. Pollan, I'm interested in hearing your analysis on the global distribution of wealth, reflecting specifically the impact on global neoliberalist policies on indigenous populations of the world. And this question is coming from my own observation that elites in developing nations who are benefiting from these free market or deregulation policies in places like Latin America tend to be of European descent.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. I mean,
Bob, before you answer that question, could I ask you, for the sake of our listeners, to define the term neoliberalism, which you use widely in your book and which is often used to characterize the sort of global policies you're going to be talking about?
Yeah. Well, thank you for asking me that, Bob. I have a little anecdote, if you don't mind, I'll share. When I drafted the book and I gave it to my wife to read, who's not in economics or politics, though a very bright and politically active person, but she said, "Why are you using this term that nobody understands?" And I tried to, I said, you know, you have a point. And I tried to think of other words like free market economics or conservative economics, but they weren't quite right. And so I stuck with it and then I defined it. So by my definition, neoliberalism is akin to what we would call, free market economics, in that the notion that, the government should play a minimal role. If the government is there already, they should, if they own things like public utilities, they should start selling them. If they're involved in trying to promote job creation, they should stop doing that. If they're involved in regulating the inflows of capital from foreign investors, they should stop doing that and let the capitalists do whatever they want to do. So I think that that's the basic idea of neoliberalism. It comes from the ideas of classical liberalism, which is kind of Adam Smith, free markets are best, but the variant of it, why it's called neoliberalism, is I think that under the current situation, the pro-business neoliberals favor free market economics if it's in their benefit, but if it's not in their benefit, they don't favor. They want the government to help them out. If for example, there's a financial crisis and they need a bailout or they're going to lose their ass, they are happy to have the government come in and bail them out. So,
yeah, this is a follow-up on this point before you answer the caller's great question. You know, I often in my classes, I use Milton Friedman's legendary text, Capitalism and Freedom.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the Bible of neoliberalism, the case for letting markets
right.
be free and having no government intervention with business and the pursuit of profit. Yet it seems when you look at the proponents of neoliberalism in the real world, not in the theory of capitalism and freedom and Milton Friedman's text, that in fact you have a huge government working on behalf of business. There's hardly a split between them. If anything, looking at the Bush administration today, it's hard to think of an administration where you've had you haven't had a closer link between the largest economic private interest and the government.
Yeah, and that's I at least in my view, that's the term neoliberalism tries to capture that we want small business, I mean small government, if it's going to be helping workers and the poor. We don't want a lot of spending on education, on health, on the environment. But for God's sakes, if we can redistribute income to the rich, if we can spend more for Halliburton and the friends of big business, then let's go with it. So that seems to capture, to me, the spirit of neoliberalism.
So let's take the caller's question now and talk about what's happening in the world and distribution of income and the ethnic dimension of this.
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, because just like in this country and throughout the, the advanced economies, the fundamental problem, it seems to me, is this issue of jobs. In developing countries, it's a similar problem, but with a different take, which is developing countries are undergoing this transition out of agriculture. And so you have people moving out of agriculture and into the cities, and you build up slums, and you build up huge problems of urban poverty. This is accelerated by neoliberalism, because neoliberalism says, well, if the U.S. agricultural producers can sell grain to us more cheaply, then that's great. That's free market. And so that the indigenous producers on the land who can't compete, they get wiped out. So the people at the top who are in business with the big neoliberal government of Latin American countries, Brazil, for example. I talk about Brazil a bit in the book. I talk about Argentina. People who are in business with them are certainly benefiting by being connected to U.S. agricultural producers, whereas the people who are on the ground, who depend on their basic agricultural, they live off their land. They're the ones that are getting wiped out. They're the ones that are suffering the most. I tell the story in the book about, in India, the effects of neoliberal policies on farmers in one region of India where they got so wiped out, where the policies of eliminating government protections from foreign agricultural producers and government subsidies for domestic producers and just government support programs led to this massive wave of suicides of small-scale farmers in India, and that's being repeated elsewhere. So I very much agree with the spirit of what the caller was saying.
Yeah, Bob, if I can just interject, though, I've been reading in the business press the last year or two and in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal about what a spectacular success the Indian economy is right now. I mean, is this due to the same neoliberal policies that have farmers, you know, killing themselves?
Yes. I mean, that's part of that's part of the irony. Success, number one, is the spectacular success is, again, it's like the Clinton administration. There are pockets of success. It is nowhere near as spectacular. I'm not an expert on the Indian economy, but people I respect who've written on this show that the growth in the Indian economy has not been extraordinary. It's been good. It's the real, I mean, extraordinary success has been China. But anyway, but the again, the distribution of the benefits have been so extreme. You do have the growth of a middle class and an upper middle class in India, and it's big. But India has 800 million people. So if you have, you know, instead of having 10 million people in the middle class, you now have 25 million. That is a major success. But that still means, you know, that you have 725 million who are not. And of the 725 million who are not, if, you know, I don't know the exact number, but tens or hundreds of millions of people who depend on the land or on basic production to survive, if they're getting hurt by neoliberalism, that is a disaster. And, of course, what the media picks up, and maybe, again, you can speak to this more than I can, because they can relate to middle-class people that are software programmers and that's, and that they're now living, they are having two cars and all that stuff. If you have, you know, if you go from 10 to 25 million people who have those, that lifestyle, that looks like a major success. And it is for those 15 million people, but for the other hundreds of million who are suffering, that's not part of the media story.
Now, what people will often say when they're confronted with the story of India or even in the United States or any other country is that that's how capitalism works. I mean, some people get ahead, they get rich, they do best, and then they'll invest, and other people will be brought along later, and those who work hardest will benefit, and those who don't want to work will stay at the bottom of the totem pole. But simply there's no other way in capitalism that, you know, you like it or lump it.
Yeah, I guess that is how capitalism works. And I guess, if that's the best we can do, I think it's pretty sad. And, if we're talking about, you know, the livelihoods, just thinking about a rich country like the United States of opportunities diminishing for the majority of the population while the rich are getting richer. I mean, under Clinton, the distribution of wealth became so skewed. The average worker under, let's just take a 10-year period, when George Bush the first left office in 1992, the average worker in the United States was making about $30,000 and the average CEO was making about $3 million. By the end of Clinton's administration, the average worker was still making less than $30,000. And the average CEO is making $13 million. So it went from 3 to 13. I mean, this is the greatest change in wealth distribution probably in U.S. history over the course of such a short period of time.
Yeah, but, Bob, let me ask you, though. What I'm confused is, I mean, are you saying that neoliberalism and capitalism are more or less than interchangeable, or are you saying that you could have a capitalism that is less severe?
You can have capitalism that's less severe. Whether we would call it social democracy or whether we would call it socialism, we can debate about these things, but certainly you can have some features of capitalism. You can have private investment being a significant part of the economy. You can have private ownership a significant part of the economy. But if it's counterbalanced by a significant public sector, public ownership, public controls, regulation, decent standards for workers, and more fundamentally and more broadly, and I try to emphasize this in a book, a basic sense of social solidarity. I mean, Adam Smith himself, the great exponent of free market capitalism, was 100% clear, and that's why I quote Adam Smith at the very beginning of my book. Adam Smith said you have to have a foundation in what he called moral sentiments, that there has to be a foundation of social solidarity in a society if you're going to have markets, because markets are competitive, there are winners, there are losers. And if we're going to let that run rampant, then that becomes an absolutely untenable society. That's what Adam Smith was talking about. So whether we call it socialism, social democracy, or whatever, what we need, if we're going to have anything like markets and private ownership, it has to be counterbalanced by institutions and policies that promote social solidarity and equality.
We're talking to Robert Pollin today, Media Matters. Bob Pollin's the author of the new book, Contours of Dissent. We have two callers who've been very patient. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Robert Pollin.
Yeah, thanks. I read a interesting piece that said if one of the reasons we're in Iraq is because if OPEC decided to trade in euros instead of dollars, that would be supposedly disastrous, which gets me to what you had said earlier, that if the dollar ever fell precipitously, the bankers would increase interest rates, and there'd be a massive redistribution of wealth from the poor to the rich. And I'm wondering if we could ever get enough understanding of what that would mean to the economy, and maybe put some sort of political pressure on Washington to stop that increase of the interest rate to try to bolster the dollar, that eventually would improve our trade deficit through higher employment and more exports. Isn't that true?
Yes. Well, I mean, the irony is, of course, if the dollar really did crash and it lost a lot of its value, that would make it easier for us to export, because all of the U.S. exports would be cheaper. And that would also make it more expensive for us to import. And so that would get rid of the trade deficit. The problem would be on the financial markets, that they would, because everyone is so invested in dollars, that would be so disruptive of investment and the normal operations of the banking system and the stock market. I mean, other countries, they don't have this problem because nobody wants their currencies. I mean, if you think about Mexico cannot run a trade deficit every year like we do, because who wants the pesos? Nobody.
And if I can interrupt also, Bob, isn't it part of the U.S. benefit of being the largest economy in the world that it's in the interest of a country like China or other countries that our economy not collapse, since we're the market for so much of their goods?
That's right. I mean, so that's why, I myself don't think that there is going to be this kind of collapse of the dollar, because China, it's just like, forget about borders for a minute. They are people holding their wealth in dollars, and they don't want that wealth to go down. So they aren't particularly interested in seeing the dollar collapse. And that's why it's very important for them to think that the U.S. government and the Federal Reserve is committed, whatever, to keep the dollar's value up. If it means raising the interest rates, so be it. Because nobody who owns the dollars wants to see the dollars collapse. And they are in a coalition, in a sense, against the U.S. worker, who would benefit from lower interest rates and a lower value of the dollar.
I'm Bob McChesney, the host of Media Matters. You're listening to Robert Polin, my guest today, the author of the new and highly acclaimed book, Contours of Dissent. Our guest on Media Matters the next few weeks. Next week, we're going to have Charles Lewis, the executive director of the Center for Public Integrity, one of the truly outstanding investigative journalists of our era. 2 weeks from today, we're fortunate to have as our guest Al Franken, who is starting to do a radio liberal radio talk show, and he's promising to offer drug-free radio talk show to America. 3 weeks today, we're going to have Ben Scott talking about Capitol Hill and the struggle on media ownership and other media policy issues from one of the people who's been leading that fight. And then 4 weeks from today, our guest will be the well-known, even legendary columnist Molly Ivins. But today, our guest, Robert Polin, we've got him for another 6 or 7 minutes. We have one caller I want to get to. But before we get to that caller, Bob, I want to ask you about the Democratic presidential candidates this year. A lot of our listeners are concerned about this election. It's a common theme on Media Matters. I assume you followed the field a little bit, looking at their coverage of economic issues. Do any of these candidates look like they're at all addressing the issues you think are important?
Well, the one that has been most forceful has been Dennis Kucinich. I was on another show, and I, as soon as I said that, I said, well, but he doesn't really have a chance, and I got pounced on, so I... he is raising the issues in a good way. I don't think the other candidates have said anything terribly interesting or progressive, and I forget whether it was Kerry or Dean who said, if you like Clinton, you're going to love me. I do think that there's some chance that once the field gets sorted out, that they may focus on things in a more serious way and start to address the issues. The fundamental problem with the Democrats, and this is the struggle that's going on in the Democratic Party, and I've had a bit of a debate with Paul Krugman about this. If they focus on the deficit as the issue, we Democrats have to be responsible and the Republicans are irresponsible. That is disastrous, in my view, both politically and substantively, because what they need to focus on is jobs and well-being for people. And the deficit is a subsidiary issue. And if they can't get that message, if they let Robert Rubin and his friends on Wall Street pound them hard enough to tell them that the deficit is the only issue, it's not going to win any votes, and it's not good for any people.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. We have a couple callers. We've only got a couple minutes left. Champagne, you're on the air with Bob Polin.
Yes, thank you. Back to an earlier call. Now, I'll say up front, I have a lot of reservations and skepticism about moving a portion of Social Security into the stock market, but it seems like if you're going to do it, the way to do it would be to invest in no-load index funds that track the entire market. That way, you know, there wouldn't be any choosing of winners and losers on the part of, like, who's going to get invested in and who's not going to get invested in, and it would reduce any high fees going to Wall Street and going to money managers and that sort of thing. And if you're going to finance it, I would say the way to do it is to take that portion, that very large chunk of money that's now being stolen from the Social Security system to subsidize tax cuts for the super wealthy, and put that portion of it that's not going to current benefits into those index funds. I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, I think that's an interesting idea. I mean, I completely embrace the spirit of what you're saying, that if we're going to try this at all, it has to be under the condition that there's no fees. That, yeah, we just take a big index fund, and that is, you know, the whole market. If the market is going to earn whatever it's earned historically, 6%, 6.5%, over the course of history, then that's what we get, and we don't go with any fluctuations, and there's no shenanigans with Wall Street people bidding to get fees and run the show. I'm just really fearful that even if we move in that direction, that's going to open the floodgates for, you know, these are very clever people. They've proven it over and over again.
The Marquis of Queensberry is not going to be drawing up these plans.
Right.
We've got one more caller here for Robert Polin. Let's go back to the phone lines for our last call. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi. Going back to the Democratic candidates for president, you know, it seems to me that the current administration has failed across the board. You know, it doesn't matter. Economics, foreign policy, education, in any way, they've lied and failed both. It would seem to me that any Democratic candidate should have a really great chance of getting rid of the Bush administration, so long as they're willing to be honest. I mean, and I know that's a big caveat, but how do you feel about that?
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I was just reading The Economist magazine has a long story this week saying that, you know, no matter what you think, Bush has a really good chance of winning. I mean, it was a 50-50 election last time. There's a lot of reasons why Bush is going to be able to appeal to that same 50%, but there's been slight redistribution of the Electoral College, so that helps Bush a little bit. And so the Democrats have to move, you know, 5 or 6% of the undecideds to thinking more like the way you're thinking and I'm thinking. And I hope it would seem easy to be able to do, because I agree that Bush is an absolute disaster in every single conceivable way.
All right. Well, I think we've settled the Bush question with you, Bob Poland. You know, we've only got about a minute left, minute and a half left. And I think the question that comes out of your critique that you probably get otherwise, but it's worth asking you too. I want to hear what you have to say. People say that if you put these prohibitions on free market, on investors, if you put public policy programs in place that interfere with the market, that basically you're going to stop the growth rate because investors won't invest if they don't feel confident that they have a pro-free market government, and that you'll sort of kill the economy, you'll kill the goose that lays the golden egg, that if you have capitalism, you basically have to let capitalists be capitalists. Well, how do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, we have a lot of evidence that that's not true. We have a lot of evidence that having a big public sector is good for the public sector and it's good for the private sector. Capitalists can have some domain of freedom, but it has to be limited. And if you limit it, you also enable them, you prevent them from making the kinds of massive mistakes that we saw them make with the stock market bubble. So I think, you know, there is opportunity for creating a society with more equality, more stability, and letting markets do some of the things that capitalists want them to do.
How has the response to your book been so far? It's been out for, what, 3, 4, or 5 months now?
Yeah, I mean, it's the people that like what I say seem very enthusiastic. I haven't gotten much response from people that don't like what I say because they probably haven't even taken a crack at looking at the book.
Okay, any last comments you'd like to make, Bob, before
we
sign off?
Just thanks a lot for having me on. I really appreciated your questions and the comments from your listeners. Were very sharp, and I learned something myself.
All right, so we got a high grade for the professor.
Absolutely.
All right, well, thank you so much, Robert Poland, for joining us today in Media Matters. Robert Poland is the author of the new and highly acclaimed book, Contours of Dissent, U.S. Economic Fractures in the Landscape of Global Austerity, published by Verso. You can find it, hopefully, online or at quality bookstores everywhere. I'm Bob McChesney, and I'd like to thank my executive producer, Victor Picard, for his great work on the show. I'll join you 1 week from today with Chuck Lewis. Until then, have a good week. Bye-bye.
Illinois voters will nominate candidates for U.S. Senate on March 16th. Join us for live debates from Illinois Public Radio and the Daily Herald. Republicans meet Tuesday, February 3rd, and Democrats Wednesday, February 4th.
Both debates start at 6:30 p.m. Central Time on AM 580 WILL Urbana.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly sunny with a high around 30 degrees and southeast winds around 15 miles per hour. Tonight, cloudy with a chance of light freezing rain and light snow after midnight, the low in the mid-20s with southeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, occasional freezing rain and snow with snow accumulation up to an inch, the high in the mid-30s with southeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.